to sing this song for the healing of the world.
Welcome to Spirit in Action. My name is Mark Helpsmeet, and each week we bring you visits and conversations with people doing healing work for this world, hearing what they're doing and what inspires them and supports them in doing it. Welcome to Spirit in Action. I deeply admire those who put their lives at service to what they believe in terms of what will serve and heal the world. Jan Spencer has done that. And since 3 months have gone by, we again now have Jan Spencer sitting in today as guest host for Spirit in Action, talking about what he calls his primer for paradigm shift, the needed ways of seeing and thinking about the world in order to become sustainable and leave our world-wrecking ways behind us. This is the sixth time we've had Jan here, teaching us how to work on creating a preferred future. Today, Jan will be balancing the theories and principles supporting this work with practical examples of putting those ideas into action. Fortunately, he's rich with examples of doing this kind of work near Eugene, Oregon, where he lives. You can track a good portion of his insights down via his YouTube videos and on his website. Jan has decades of experience with the work of permaculture, lifestyle, and environmental modification to live toward the preferred future we want, and many of his resources address those particulars, but the Primer for Paradigm Shift is the big overview. We'll let him get on with this work as I pass the microphone to Jan Spencer, leading us for Spirit in Action today from Eugene, Oregon.
Thanks, Mark. It's good to be with you again here on Spirit in Action Radio. This is Jan Spencer coming to you from Eugene, Oregon. Let's spend just a few moments on getting acquainted. My interests are a convergence of economics, lifestyle, the environment, urban land use, permaculture, and paradigm shift. I also have a big interest. Just how did humanity arrive to this point we're familiar with today? Unimaginable levels of affluence and consumption, plus unimaginable numbers of problems, challenges, and worrisome trends. My focus is, what choices can we make in our own lives, homes, and communities to address climate change, social disequity, a severely damaged natural world, lost positive human potential, and a whole lot more. My ideal is for humanity to live within the boundaries of the natural world, that society would have a primary focus of bringing out the best in positive human potential, and that society would be served by an economic system that was honest and accountable. I don't believe capitalism and the consumer culture are compatible with environmental sustainability and social uplift. That's why I choose to use my time in Spirit in Action Radio to describe a book I'm writing called A Primer for Paradigm Shift. The primer contains a good bit of criticism of the current system, but by far most of the primer describes actions we can take in our own lives, at home, in our communities and neighborhoods to repair the damage. A good part of the primer describes people and groups already working on the ground in the real world, creating healthy alternatives to the consumer culture. In this episode for Spirit in Action Radio, I'd like to share some very fascinating research into the realm I describe as social engineering. While Noam Chomsky favors the term manufactured consent, do you think many people would be surprised or upset to consider their lives, their culture, their worldviews were an enormously successful fabrication for economic and social control? Of course, that's not a comforting thought. We'll take a closer look. And then we'll zero in to several on-the-ground, real-life examples of alternatives to that manufactured consent. But first, my most recent two episodes on Spirit in Action Radio. This review builds context for today's episode. Search Jan Spencer. In February, I described several aspects of A Primer for Paradigm Shift. That episode included a critique of capitalism, including the observation, millions of jobs exist to repair the damage caused by the products and services of millions of other jobs. We touched on an extremely important term known as external costs. We looked at reducing ecological footprints by using the footprint calculator. We learned about allies and assets in the community and heard about several on-the-ground alternatives to the consumer culture. The May episode was about taking paradigm shift out to a wider audience. We considered becoming a more effective advocate for paradigm shift in our own lives. Important to that advocacy is being the change we want to see. We considered that virtually every progressive public interest organization, social, environmental, political, public health, all exist to repair some type of damage created by capitalism, overconsumption, and the consumer culture. Therefore, they're all on the same team and could be working much more closely together. Thousands of groups and millions of people on the same team suggest we have the potential for an enormously wide and deep public mass movement to replace capitalism and the consumer culture. And finally, I described why capitalism deserves an invitation to a truth and reconciliation process, an exploration, an investigation, an accounting for the many wrongs imposed on people and planet by capitalism and the consumer culture. Okay, let's move on. An important term relevant to both truth and reconciliation and the primer is social engineering. A month ago, I would have explained social engineering in a fairly simple way. Essentially, we've all lived our lives in the consumer culture and been on the receiving end of many thousands of commercial messages since we were kids. That's commercials in print, on the radio, on TV, billboards, the suburban and affluent lifestyles on TV shows and movies, the big cars, the big houses, the fancy lifestyles. Of course, all that messaging is there to create wants and for people to aspire to have all that stuff too. Where did all that messaging come from? Even as a critic of the consumer culture and its celebrated overconsumption, I was taken back by digging a bit deeper into that question. Where did all this messaging come from? I was vaguely aware of Noam Chomsky's use of the phrase manufactured consent, and I knew Ralph Nader made reference to the idea of growing up corporate. I was also a big fan of the iconic book Your Money or Your Life, written by Vicki Robbins and Joe Dominguez. But it's only recently, I confess, I've become a good bit more educated myself in regard to social engineering and manufactured consent. We elevate the cause for paradigm shift when we clearly understand how and why the consumer culture came into being. The consumer culture is not an accident. It's a manufactured condition by certain interests with certain purposes for certain outcomes. The consumer culture is social engineering. It's manufactured consent. It's not sustainable, and it depends on replacing positive human potential and social uplift with vanity and excess consumption of energy and resources that's ruining the planet. It's really very important in terms of paradigm shift to understand more clearly how this commercial messaging has come to dominate our lives. I can't think of anyone better to connect these dots than Noam Chomsky. I'd like to share an excerpt from an article Noam Chomsky wrote for Z Magazine in 1991. Chomsky makes reference to public relations pioneer Edward Bernays and social commentator Walter Lippmann. Bernays was making a name for himself from the 20s until the 60s, and Lippmann was a well-known journalist, writer, and commentator contemporary to Bernays. They share many political and social points of view. Chomsky explains how Bernays and Lippmann identify the two basic roles of society. First, the few and the chosen who guide society, and then the masses who need to be guided. So I'll read a couple of minutes from that Chomsky article in Z Magazine. It's information dense, and afterwards I'll add a bit more explanation. Again, our social engineering and manufactured consent is nothing new. The excerpt begins with Chomsky quoting Edward Bernays. Here's the quote. "The conscious and intelligent manipulation of the organized habits and opinions of the masses is an important element in democratic society. It is the intelligent minorities that need to make use of propaganda continuously and systematically." Next is Chomsky. "It follows that two political roles must be clearly distinguished." Lippmann goes on to explain, "First, there is the role assigned to the specialized class, the insiders, the responsible men who have access to information and understanding. Ideally, they should have a special education for public office and should master the criteria for solving the problems of society." Chomsky continues to quote Lippmann. "The public men lead opinion and take the responsibility for the formation of sound public opinion. They initiate, they administer, they settle, and should be protected from the ignorant and meddlesome outsiders, the general public who are incapable of dealing with the substance of the problem." Lippmann explains, "A successful government satisfies the material and cultural wants of the masses." Note, keep this last sentence about government success in mind. We're going to refer to it again shortly. Chomsky continues with describing Lippmann's do's and don'ts of the general public. "It is not for the public," Lippmann observes, "to pass judgment on the intrinsic merits of an issue or to offer analysis or solutions, but merely on occasion to place its force at the disposal of one or another group of responsible men. The public does not reason, investigate, invent, persuade, bargain, or settle." Lippmann continues, "The public acts only by aligning itself as the partisan of someone in a position to act executively. The public must be put in its place. The bewildered herd, trampling and roaring, has its function to be the interested spectators of action, not participants." That's all I have from that article. Chomsky's article is 30 years old, and he's making comments from Lippmann and Bernays that predate the article by half a century. A healthy society does need a coherent set of ideals, values, and goals that bind it together. But the consumer culture is not the ticket. The vision that Bernays and Lippmann describe is, of course, exactly what we have in 2024 America. The condition that Lippmann and Bernays describe is not totally mistaken. Personally, a 2-hour board meeting once a month with my neighborhood association is about all the wonky, formal, and semi-boring meeting and decision-making I can handle. I'm glad there are wonky people who like meetings, talking about policy, making decisions. That's good. Let's return to our interest in social engineering. Edward Bernays can take a lot of the credit for the rise of overconsumption and the consumer culture, but he was not alone. Let's take a closer look. Edward Bernays was born in Austria in 1891, and his family moved to the United States when he was just a child. Interestingly, his mom was Sigmund Freud's sister, and his dad was Sigmund Freud's wife's brother. The family was upper middle class. Bernays degreed in agriculture, but over the years found his way into the commercial realm of advertising and promotion. Over the decades of the 20s, 30s, 40s, and 50s, he built quite a resume with successful product campaigns, including hand soap, bananas, and serving-sized ice cream containers. But he's best known for a book he wrote called Propaganda, which explained the tactics of mass information. He was putting the social psychology of his uncle, Sigmund Freud, to work. Two of his most well-known public relations projects included a campaign in the 20s and 30s encouraging women to smoke cigarettes. In the 1950s, Bernays was a big part of a public relations project to burnish and sanitize the credentials of the new strongman of Guatemala, who was installed as president by way of a CIA-engineered coup in 1953. Bernays was not an authoritarian, but he and his circle of friends believed a certain type of democracy called for men of means, character, and intellect to be the policy and decision-makers of society, while the role of the masses was to behave properly and not to interfere with the decision-makers. Bernays considered this social and political management was a responsibility and could be done in a benign way for the good of the people. Better to have responsible men taking the initiative for the good of the public rather than to leave these important tasks to others with less altruism. So, how to keep the wayward masses happy and distracted? Again, for their own good. So how are the masses kept happy and distracted? Recall the excerpt from Chomsky's article just a few minutes ago. The criteria we apply to government are success in satisfying material and cultural wants. At this critical point in our discussion, I'll share my interpretation. The need to keep the general public, the masses, the so-called bewildered herd, distracted, converges with the need for a robust, growth-based, hyperactive economy and a socially engineered culture where buying and consuming is a primary function of life. In other words, the consumer culture, the American dream, manifest destiny, and American exceptionalism. To emphasize this assessment of the convergence of the needs to keep the bewildered herd in its place, by products and entertainment, and to boost an economy based on overconsumption. Let's hear these three quotes. In his groundbreaking book, Propaganda, Edward Bernays wrote in 1928, "Mass production is profitable only if its rhythm can be maintained, that is, if it can continue to sell its product in a steady stream or increasing quantity. Today, supply must actively seek to create its corresponding demand and cannot afford to wait until the public asks for its product. It must maintain constant touch through advertising and propaganda to assure itself the continuous demand, which alone will make its costly plant profitable." Victor Lebel, a 20th century economist and retail analyst, remarked in 1955, "Our enormously productive economy demands that we make consumption our way of life, that we convert the buying and use of goods into rituals, that we seek our spiritual satisfaction, our ego satisfaction in consumption. We need things consumed, burned up, replaced, and discarded at an ever-accelerating rate." And finally, more up-to-date, Stuart Ewan, a contemporary historian, author, and lecturer on media and the consumer culture, interviewed Edward Bernays himself in 1990. This is how Ewan describes his conversation with Bernays. "Throughout our conversation, Bernays conveyed his hallucination of democracy. A highly educated class of opinion-molding tacticians is continuously at work, adjusting the mental scenery from what the public mind, with its limited intellect, derives its opinion. Throughout the interview, he, Bernays, described public relations as a response to a trans-historic concern, the requirement for those people in power to shape the attitudes of the general population. Mission accomplished. Electing representatives to look after our own particular interests is not a bad idea. We can't fit the whole city in the city council chambers. We can't fit the entire nation in the Senate or the House of Representatives. And most people wouldn't want to be there anyway. The problem is, the approach to keeping the masses of disinterested people occupied and distracted has created at least three very important problems. First problem, the consumer lifestyle, and even lifestyles on the lower rungs of the economic ladder, and much more so the well-off, are causing climate change, economic, social, and political disequity, widespread damage to the natural world. While the masses are distracted, those who manage the political and economic system are paying themselves enormous amounts of money because they're selling the products that distract everybody else. They have an economic interest to maintain their position and privilege. The second big problem, a life based on overconsumption, cars, and distractions, deprives us of the capacity instead to imagine healthy alternatives to the consumer culture. And then the third problem, the consumer culture and its distractions has degraded our social and organizational skills for working together, for moving towards sustainability, social uplift, and real democracy. Just think, tens and tens of millions of people spend vast amounts of money and their own time on products and distractions that interfere with their making important decisions in their own lives, in their own best interests. From this perspective, to assume those who are getting rich from this century-old economic fabrication, this social engineering, this manufactured consent to apologize and make way for paradigm shift is sure to disappoint. Can Bernays and friends take credit for the consumer culture in our contemporary disempowered society? No matter whether Bernays can claim 1% credit or 50% credit, the conditions he and his colleagues envisioned fit perfectly the distracted and disempowered consumer culture that we live in today, and the wealthy insiders who profit from it. Do you recall the statement, "The American way of life is non-negotiable"? Do I think there's an active, ongoing central control with weekly meetings calling the shots for social engineering and the consumer culture? No, I don't. But there is a logic and momentum to the way the economic system works, and as long as people continue to buy the products to overconsume and remain distracted, we can only expect more of the same problems we're now familiar with, except growing worse, and building to a point where something is going to break from the social, economic, and environmental stress. A word used with increasing frequency these days to describe our present condition is a polycrisis. Meanwhile, on the hopeful side, we have a mass movement incubating. When thousands of public interest organizations and their millions of members more fully understand how capitalism and its insiders have socially engineered the consumer culture and its wide range of deepening problems, they can come together in common cause as a massive transformative movement on behalf of sustainability and social uplift. After a short break, we'll hear some stories about paradigm shift in action. Okay, Mark, your turn.
I know you're deep in the midst of the thoughts and analysis of Jan Spencer and his Primer of Paradigm Shift and eager to hear the examples he'll be sharing. So I'll be quick to remind you that this is Spirit in Action, and our website is northernspiritradio.org, where we have links to all of our guests for both Spirit in Action, Song of the Soul, but in particular for today's guest host, Jan Spencer. NordenSpiritRadio.org is home base for us, so use it to track down info, post feedback on the site to us to enhance our mutual knowledge. Check out the 35 or so radio stations across the country where our shows are syndicated, and don't forget the more than 15 aggregators where you can also access our broadcasts as podcasts. Please donate to support Northern Spirit Radio. We really need your help to be sustainable. We need a couple $1,000s to make it to our end of the year fundraiser. Help make us sustainable with your help. And please help your local community radio station. They do such great work with so little money. Let's head back to Jan Spencer's Primer for Paradigm Shift and hear those stories and examples of working for a sustainable future for our planet.
Thanks, Mark. Real-life examples of paradigm shift is one of my favorite topics. I love to hear stories, read about examples of individuals in groups, and even visit in-person pioneers of paradigm shift. Paradigm shift is a process, not so much a destination. It can happen in the here and now. We don't have to wait to experience many of the benefits of paradigm shift in our own lives as soon as we care to make the effort. Core to paradigm shift is how we prioritize our own time and money for living within the boundaries of the natural world and building civic culture. The book I'm writing, A Primer for Paradigm Shift, will have extended descriptions of all kinds of examples of creating a preferred future. Remember, many of these actions we can take don't need any permission from anyone. We can take these initiatives in our own lives anytime we care to. And the more people who do, the better, when people in groups engaged in paradigm shift meet each other, they cross-fertilize, they collaborate, they make common cause to expand the scale of social, political, economic, and environmental transformation. Okay, let's hear some examples of paradigm shift in the real world. We'll start with my own suburban transformation project right here where I live in Eugene on my quarter-acre suburban property. I bought this modest home and property 24 years ago with the intention of permaculture transformation. I wanted to show what a nothing special suburban property could look like. Grassed garden front and back, edible landscaping all over, much of it elevated, garage to living space. I took out the driveway and replaced it with a storage shed and more edible landscaping. I don't have a car, and housemates park out along the street. The south side patio is now enclosed, passive solar. I have a 6,500-gallon rainwater system. 15 years ago, I built a 400-square-foot passive solar accessory dwelling unit. It's detached from the main house, and it's my space. I grow almost all my own fruit and vegetables. Literally, thousands of people have visited my place to see what a nothing special suburban property can become. I've done most of the work myself. And one of the primary goals also is to reduce my ecological footprint. I rent 3 rooms in my house. My place is absolutely beautiful. There are 2 water features and a great deal of biodiversity. Half of all Americans live in suburbia. Transforming suburbia, as I've done here on my own property, could create thousands and thousands of jobs and reduce ecological footprints and help densify suburbia. That could help protect nearby farmland from suburban sprawl and could also increase residential density that could be a boost for public transportation. Transforming a suburban property is at the base of the paradigm shift pyramid. More people with these kinds of interests could lead to taking fences down. Property would still be private, but there could be much more effective use of space without so many fences. Plus, neighbors could work much more effectively with each other to build community resilience and reduce eco-footprints. We'll hear more about transforming suburbia elsewhere, but first, a closer look at my own neighborhood. There are other permaculture properties and people with these same ideas nearby in my neighborhood. We've had dozens of site tours over the years to see what different people are doing where they live. 2 of my next-door neighbors are also into permaculture. We've had small permaculture gatherings here in the neighborhood over the years. Our neighborhood hosted the 2015 Northwest Permaculture Convergence, the largest permaculture event of the year in the Pacific Northwest. It was a suburban permaculture convergence. One of the ideals of paradigm shift is making good use of available assets, like transforming a suburban property, or using the neighborhood recreation center and turning that rec center into a weekend permaculture, social change, paradigm shift university. We had plenary sessions, site tours, breakout groups, an outdoor expo. Much of the event was free. Part of the event you paid. It was low cost. Most of the organizing work was done by people here in our neighborhood. We figure something like 700 people participated in one way or another. almost guaranteed there are more allies and assets in practically any neighborhood than most people would imagine. One of the most practical, easy ways to start making connections is to organize a little site tour to see people's gardens. Identify 4 or 5, 6 places to visit. Have the person who lives there tell the visitors what they're doing. If you have a neighborhood association, you could ask them to help promote the site tour. You could even finish the site tour with a potluck in a park or at somebody's place. East Blair Housing Co-op in Eugene is one of my favorite places because it has so many social, economic, and land use examples of paradigm shift. The co-op owns 7 properties, so it can coordinate the land use of those properties for the good of the entire co-op, not just the people who live on those properties. Imagine a group of neighbors in suburbia. They could coordinate their use of properties together in a similar way to East Blair for making better use of the space they have. East Blair had a 10-car parking lot years ago, and they took it out. Where there used to be cars parking is now edible landscaping. It's a party space. There's picnic tables. There's a fire pit. There's food-producing plants all around where there used to be cars. Some people at East Blair live in the modest townhouses, and those townhouses don't have much space, but they can have a garden elsewhere on co-op property where there is space. East Blair is mostly lower income, and when you're a member, you have responsibilities to the co-op. East Blair has different working groups to look after the needs of the co-op. People learn important social skills for working together. Those are social and communication skills people can use in other places at other times in their life. About 50 people live at East Blair. You can search East Blair Housing Co-op, Eugene, Oregon. Find their website. You can learn more. Another one of my favorite places in Eugene is Duma Cooperative. Duma is a single large house, home to about 10 people. They live in a cooperative way. One of the main ideas is to build their social relations, but also to reduce their ecological footprints. Duma has a beautiful kitchen, shared spaces. The place is 3 stories high, and the basement is used also. Outdoors, a full-on permaculture edible landscaping. And there are playful place-making features out front, including a tree stump with words on it. You can write some poetry when you're passing by. There's also a kissing booth, where people are encouraged to kiss somebody in this very nice enclosed space. In the back, what used to be a gravel parking lot is now a thriving garden. We've had many site tours, including Duma. Again, you can look up Duma Co-op, Eugene, Oregon, and find out more. Another favorite entity in Eugene is Hummingbird Wholesale. I've known the owners of Hummingbird for decades, and I've watched the natural food wholesaling business increase in size and in scope also. They do more than sell natural foods in bulk. Hummingbird serves grocery stores and food co-ops, restaurants and food services, food product manufacturers, and buying clubs. We have a buying club here in my neighborhood, and we buy from Hummingbird. For me, that means olive oil, balsamic vinegar, different beans, grains, occasionally dried fruit, nutritional yeast. From their website, Hummingbird's motto is, "Sip the nectar, without harming the flower. This also from the Hummingbird website. We are instrumental in transforming the world toward a sustainable food production system which supports the health of the people who depend on it, as well as the Earth's precious ecosystems. We offer organic, high-quality, nutritious foods grown as locally and sustainably as possible. We take great care and pride in creating long-term, mutually beneficial relationships. I'd like to briefly describe two very important, interesting aspects of Hummingbird Wholesale. First, support for local farmers in developing a more local food system. I'm going to read from the Hummingbird website about the Farm Connections program. Here are some highlights. We contract with farmers up front before the planting season to buy a set amount of a crop at a set price. We help farmers find seed for crops we're interested in, and sometimes we front the cost of the seed. The farmer pays the seed cost back only if the crop is successful. Hummingbird pays a higher price to farmers who are transitioning towards organic. We cover other upfront costs for farmers who are trying an experimental crop we're interested in. We shoulder much of the marketing work to make sure there are customers for the healthful organic crops we ask farmers to grow. Another food system project. We collaborated with a local farm to establish Camas Country Mill. It's the first regional grain mill to be operating in the Willamette Valley in about 80 years, in a place where Oregon-grown grains can be locally milled into flour. There's more. We host an incubator kitchen in our building to foster small food businesses that are developing innovative and healthy food products. Next aspect for Hummingbird. Original owners of Hummingbird, Charlie and Julie Tilt, no longer own Hummingbird. Here's the story again from their website. In January 2023, Hummingbird owners Charlie and Julie Tilt made a bold move by transitioning their ownership of the company to an employee-owned purpose trust, securing and guiding the mission and values of the business into perpetuity. That's forever. The co-workers elect the trust committee, which appoints the board. The board oversees the CEO, who works in partnership with the leadership team and co-workers to carry out the business of serving our customers, building relationships with vendors, and supporting healthy farming outcomes. You can find more at hummingbirdwholesale.com. Without question, Hummingbird makes its nest in Paradigm Shift. Another wonderful organization I know of is the Onondaga Earth Corps in Syracuse, New York. Several years ago, when I had a radio show, I interviewed two young people involved with the Earth Corps. They were very enthusiastic about the Onondaga Earth Corps, and for good reason. Both my young friends involved with the Earth Corps felt personally empowered to be a part of making where they live a better place for people and the environment. I'm going to read just a little bit from their website. Mission and Vision, Onondaga Earth Corps. The mission of the OEC is to empower youth to be active participants in creating positive change for themselves, their communities, and the environment. Here's more. The OEC helps youth understand the relationship between people and the urban ecosystem. The OEC engages youth in hands-on community and environmental service learning projects. The OEC trains youth for future jobs and careers in environmental fields. And the OEC empowers youth by developing their leadership abilities that help them analyze situations, solve problems, and implement strategies to improve their community. I wish every city and town had its own counterpart to the Onondaga Earth Corps. Every person, young, old, and in between, deserves a positive opportunity for self-development and service to the community. Next, let's take a look at Local 2020, an impressive community organization in Port Townsend, located on Washington State's Olympic Peninsula. Again, I'm going to read from Local 2020's website. Local 2020 is an all-volunteer grassroots organization located in East Jefferson County, Washington. Local 2020 is dedicated to promoting self-reliance, sustainability, and resiliency at a community level, moving toward a lighter environmental footprint and a greater capacity to adapt to the challenges of climate change and economic instability. Most of what happens in Local 2020 happens in action groups, each focused on a different, in parentheses, though interrelated, aspect of sustainability. Those action groups include Beyond Waste, Climate Action, Economic Localization, Emergency Preparedness, Health and Wellness, Local Food, Transportation Lab. Other groups can be added to these. Let's take a short look at economic localization. Again, from the website. Learn about how LION, that's an acronym, L-I-O-N, helps to facilitate investment in the local economy by matching local investors to local businesses seeking to expand. So let's just go a little bit deeper with LION. LION stands for Local Investing Opportunities Network. I'm going to read again from the 2020 website. LION is not a loan or investment fund, and it does not make collective investment decisions. Our membership consists of local citizens who support local businesses and invest their money locally, putting their investing money to work within our community. Keeping funds local facilitates greater economic self-sufficiency, job growth, economic development, and dollar multiplier effect, whereby a dollar kept within the community can be spent many times over for a greater benefit than a dollar invested away from our community. I'm going to say enough with Local 2020. Their website has much more information about all these working groups. That website is l2020.org. That's a small L, L2020.org, or you can search Local 2020, Port Townsend, Washington. Let's take a look at one of my very, very favorite urban transformation initiatives. Its popular English term, superblocks. We go to Barcelona, Catalonia, in Spain. I've spent some time in Barcelona and had a good chance with a bicycle to check out these superblocks. First of all, Barcelona's urban density is greater than almost any city in the United States, but not because of tall buildings, but because everybody lives in an apartment block 6, 7, 8 stories high. Even more, much of Barcelona's streets are in a grid pattern, which facilitates implementing superblocks. Urban density is an important feature here. Barcelona's population is similar to Atlanta, Georgia. Because of Atlanta's spread out, sprawling suburban development, it takes up almost 25 times more space than Barcelona. Transforming our urban places is an essential part of paradigm shift, and an essential part of transforming our urban places is to reduce our dependence on automobiles, to repurpose streets, parking lots, and intersections. Superblocks are all about improving urban quality of life. That's quieter cities, that's cleaner air, that's more open space for recreation, socializing, and just hanging out. Barcelona's urban mobility plan is intended to reduce use and need for automobiles and improve options for bikes, walking, and transit. Superblocks are, without question, the most stunning aspect of Barcelona's urban mobility plan. I'll confess, I was stunned. Okay, here's what a superblock is. Imagine one side of a Rubik's Cube. That's 9 squares. Think of those cracks between squares and the perimeter as streets. Each of those squares represents an urban block, home to maybe 10 to 15,000 people. The key to superblocks is that the perimeter streets are open to two-way traffic, cross-town traffic. At the same time, all those streets of those 9 blocks within the perimeter are one-way and limited only to people who live within those blocks, and of course, emergency and delivery vehicles. That reduces traffic immensely right there. Plus, most of those interior streets trade a lane for traffic and on-street parking in favor of bikes, pedestrians, landscaping, benches, and picnic tables. And then when the streets reach these intersections, you can only turn right. You can't cross the intersection. That means most of the space in the intersection can be turned into a park and open space. I've kicked a soccer ball with kids in a space that used to be a busy automobile intersection. It was quiet. Kids were playing. People were sitting on benches. People were reading magazines and newspapers. Businesses at street level, residential above, trees all around. All this used to be a noisy, congested, polluted automobile intersection. The effect was stunning. Barcelona's plan is to create dozens and dozens of superblocks. You can find videos on superblocks on YouTube. Search Superblocks Barcelona. Superblocks can be adapted to many urban environments. Superblocks are urban paradigm shift right now. In future installments of Spirit Radio, we'll take a look at more examples of paradigm shift. You can also search Jan Spencer Paradigm Shift on YouTube and see videos based on the book I'm writing, A Primer for Paradigm Shift. Please support Spirit in Action Radio. Make a donation. Suggest to your friends to tune in. Okay, I'm finished. I'm returning the mic to Mark.
Thanks, Jan, for giving the mic back to me. Remember, folks, that the links are on NordenspiritRadio.org, so you can continue to connect with Jan Spencer's work on the primer and creating a sustainable future. We'll have Jan back with us in 3 months, so you'll have some time to put into practice what he's talking about. We'll have more good world-healing workers with us when you join us next week for Spirit in Action. The theme music for this program is Turning of the World, performed by Sarah Thompson. Check out all things Spirit in Action on northernspiritradio.org. Guests, links, stations, and a place for your feedback, suggestions, and support. Thanks for listening. I'm Mark Helpsmeet, and I hope you find deep roots to support you to grow steadily toward the light. This is Spirit in Action. With every voice.
with every song, we will move this world along, and our lives will feel the echo.